If you have a legal question for Karen Conti, Karen will be taking your calls at the top of the hour, and she won't even charge you. Call 312-981-7200. That's 312-981-7200.
Welcome back. We're talking about the Jason Van Dyke trial coming up in Chicago this week. I believe that it's going to be there's going to be cameras in the courtroom, and we're going to be watching at least portions of it, if not all of it. And we're going to have a jury selection starting this week. And with us tonight is a special guest who's going to be talking a little bit about how you represent police officers and what are some of the interesting considerations there are. Joining me is Laura Scarry, who is a partner in the law firm of Deano and Scarry. The focus of her practice is representing police officers and agencies in matters of excessive force, deadly force, search and seizure, failure to train, and racial profiling. She was a police officer herself for 6 years. She is a certified force science analyst, and she teaches for the Police Law Institute, providing training for law enforcement. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Karen. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's nice to have you. And I'm really interested in getting to the issue of how do you prepare a trial like this? So you get hired to represent a person who is charged with a crime like this, or maybe a civil action, you know, similar types of things. How do you start putting your case together, and what are you looking for?
Well, I think in this case, there are two key factors that we have to take into consideration. And, of course, the biggest factor is the evidence, and I think we all can agree that the video footage, in particular, the one, is extremely important in this case. And then the other thing that the defense has to do is they really have to make a considerable effort to humanize Jason Van Dyke. So those are extremely important in this type of a case. Regarding the video, the defense should stress that the video was merely a small piece of the puzzle in determining the truth of what happened. I think we can all certainly agree that the video will have a tremendous impact in the case, but it is certainly not representative of all, nor does it provide a full account of what transpired. Those other pieces of the puzzle will obviously be filled in by witnesses, witness accounts of what transpired both before and during the incident, and as well as other video footage, as well as the police testimony. So, and of course, the most important piece of the puzzle is the account of Jason Van Dyke, the officer that is being charged in this case.
So let me talk about that in a minute. Let's talk about what is going to come in and what's not going to come in. I'm following this very carefully. There are a lot of talk about Laquan McDonald's background, and this young man had a lot of trouble in his background. His family life was not stable. He was in and out of trouble. He had many issues and run-ins and problems in the system. A kid, you know, just you got to feel sorry for him in some ways, because he just did not have the advantages in life that most people have. How does that come into play? It's obvious that Jason Van Dyke's lawyers want to paint Laquan McDonald as trouble and as a criminal and to kind of dehumanize him. Is that a fair thing to do when you represent police officers?
Well, in terms of fairness, I don't know that that's the case. I mean, of course, the defense is they want to have admitted the troubled past of Laquan McDonald to be exposed to the jury. And if Officer Van Dyke knew about that history,
right,
before confronting him that night, then certainly an argument can be made that that's relevant.
Sure.
But in this case, I'm not so sure that Officer Van Dyke knew of Laquan McDonald's troubled past, and whether it's his brushes with the law or other negative behavior, it is certainly going to be very difficult for the defense to convince the judge that this needs to come in.
Because the key is, what did Jason Van Dyke reasonably believe when he pulled out his gun and when he used deadly force?
That is 100% correct.
And Laquan McDonald did not have his criminal record rap sheet on his chest at the time.
That's right.
So he doesn't know. And then what about Jason Van Dyke's background? My research, and of course, I'm reading this off the internet, it could be false, could be true, that there were 53 commendations in his file, his personnel file, and there were 20 complaints that were lodged against him. I don't know the results of all of them. I know there were some lawsuits. Are any of those things going to come in, and should they?
Well, of course, the defense thinks the commendations should come in, right, and into evidence, and because they want to highlight the positive aspects of Officer Van Dyke and his career. And of course, the prosecution thinks that the complaints against Officer Van Dyke are important. But the key issue is whether Officer Van Dyke's commendations and or complaints are relevant to whether or not he committed first degree murder.
Okay, so how would that be? So let's just say that he had a case. I'm going to just an example that he had a case where he pulled out his gun on an African American potential defendant, and maybe used excessive force in handcuffing him. Let's just say that that's the case.
Right?
How is that relevant as to how he treated Laquan McDonald on that night?
It could be relevant. A judge may feel that it is relevant, but that's not the only question. Because while some evidence can be relevant, a judge can exclude the evidence if its probative value is substantially outweighed by the danger of unfair prejudice.
Okay, now we got to talk about what those words mean.
Right.
The probative value. Probative, you got to define it,
right,
for us.
Right. So. Well, the probative value means essentially, you know, is this evidence of Officer Van Dyke's ability or a capability to do, it's his history of whether or not he engaged in this kind of conduct. And so does it mean it's probative of whether he did or engaged in the same activity on this particular night?
Does it help the jury make the right decision, I guess, in
right.
some ways, to make it really simple? And then the other side of that, or does it prejudice the jury in a way that is unfair, that doesn't go right to the issue that we need to address?
That's exactly right.
We're going to take a break. If anyone has any questions about the upcoming trial of Jason Van Dyke and what it means to defend a police officer, give us a call here at 981-7200 or text to 312-981-7200. You're listening to Karen Conti, and I'm talking to Laura Scarry on WGN. We're talking with Laura Scarry, who is a lawyer who represents police officers in cases of excessive force, deadly force, malicious prosecution, failure to train, racial profiling, and the like. I want to get down to this, and this is maybe a little bit complicated, but I think it's crucial to understand what might happen at this trial. Let's start out by looking at what the law says about when a police officer can take out a gun and use deadly force.
Okay. Well, we have a statute that is it's complicated even for lawyers.
Yes.
And it's complicated for police officers, and so it certainly is going to be complicated for a layperson to understand. But what I'm going to do is I'm just going to talk about some of the scenarios that may come into play in terms of how the statute is analyzed compared to Officer Van Dyke's actions. So. In a part of the statute, Officer Van Dyke would be justified in using deadly force if he reasonably believed that he or other individuals on the scene would suffer a great bodily injury or a catastrophic injury or death. In this case, Laquan McDonald was armed with a knife, which, of course, is a deadly weapon. And if Officer Van Dyke can articulate that he reasonably believed that he or others in the area were in danger of suffering great bodily harm or death by Laquan McDonald, then his use of force can be justified.
Okay.
So that's one aspect of the statute. So now there's a couple of other aspects of the statute that come into play. And again, this only applies to police officers. This does not apply to, you know, the private citizen. So the second basis that can provide justification for Officer Van Dyke's use of deadly force is that he shot Laquan McDonald because he was resisting arrest by Chicago police officers. So by the time Officer Van Dyke came to the scene, you know, other officers were trying to subdue Laquan McDonald verbally. I mean, I'm not talking about hands-on,
right?
But in order for an individual to resist arrest, it doesn't necessarily mean resistance by physical activity. The fact that he's disobeying officer commands is resisting arrest. So in this case, if Laquan McDonald was resisting arrest by the Chicago police officers and he was attempting to escape by the use of a deadly weapon, use of deadly force can be, or the deadly force can be used by.
So he's resisting arrest,
right,
and he's trying to escape with the deadly weapon.
Right.
So that, you can fit those facts that we know about. Obviously, we don't know all of them.
That's right.
We can fit those facts into that law.
That's right. That's right. So that's the second basis that can justify Officer Van Dyke's use of deadly force. And then finally, the law provides that Officer Van Dyke can use deadly force if Laquan McDonald was resisting arrest by Chicago police officers, again, just like in the second scenario that I described, and Officer Van Dyke reasonably believed that Mr. McDonald indicated that he would endanger another person unless he is arrested without delay. So again, you know, we don't know all the facts, but based on what it is that we do know, we can certainly fit those facts within the parameters of this Illinois law.
He slashed a tire of a police car and supposedly lunged at a police officer,
right.
Did not resist arrest by not stopping.
That's right.
And then was walking down the street with a knife.
That's correct.
So, again, I think a lot of people who are reporting on this and talking about it are saying self-defense, like you and I are self-defense, which is someone pulls out something, I can only use deadly force when someone pulls deadly force and threatens my life. Not the same law.
That's right.
That applies to
That's
police
right.
officers for good reason.
Right. And, you know, this is a specific statute that is specific to the state of Illinois. And, you know, we've got to be mindful. We can't compare this case to another case from Florida
right.
or Missouri because the laws are different for police officers. So, you know, and they may be somewhat similar. So we've got to look at this, you know, using Illinois state law. And we have this law on the books. And whether or not we agree with that
right.
law, we've got to abide by it.
And the jurors, you know, are going to have to put aside their prejudice and passion. And, you know, whether they think, gosh, this guy just blew this guy away, he shouldn't have done that. When you look at the law, it becomes a whole different creature to me. That if it's very cut and dry what the analysis has to be. Whether you come down on a guilty or an acquittal, you still have a different set of factors that you have to think about.
You're 100%, Karen. And you know, you bring up another point. You know, when it comes to selecting the jury, you know, one of the questions that the defense is going to want to ask, and it's an important question, I think, for all defendants who are police officers, whether it's in a criminal matter such as this or in a civil case, we want jurors to be asked whether or not they can abide by the reading of the law and put aside their differences with the law. So, you know, if we've got a potential juror that, you know, hedges and says, well, you know, what if I don't like the law? Well, that's a juror that I'm not going to want to have on
sure.
In the case.
Right. Let's go to the phones. I think we have Anthony. Hi, Anthony. You have a question for Laura.
Hi, Karen. Well, I had actually two quick questions. One, once somebody doesn't comply with police instructions, and I've seen this over and over again in all these supposed unjustified uses of force by police, seems to me if this individual would have stopped, put his hands over his head, and surrendered, we wouldn't even have this discussion. You know what I mean? Doesn't that open him up to pretty much, you know, you can't get inside Jason Van Dyke's mind and determine whether or not he feared for his life. And if I'm a juror, unless I really think that he got up in the morning and said, I'm going to kill an African-American today, you know, you have to believe that that's how he felt at that time.
How do you respond to that, Laura?
Well, you know, it's interesting because this is a conversation that a lot of lawyers on the defense side of police officers, you know, we talk about this. You talk about the high-profile cases. You talk about the Michael Brown case. You talk about, you know, the case in Oklahoma involving Officer Betty Shelby. There are all of these high-profile cases involving individuals who are not complying with police orders. And, you know, that's unfortunately, you know, this show is not about societal problems and, you know, how we can get people to comply with police orders, you know, but I have to wonder what would have happened in all of these high profile cases, you know, and I think most people would agree that we wouldn't be here.
Right. And everyone should take note of that and,
right.
and tell their kids what to do in the event there is a police involvement. But Anthony, quickly,
doesn't it only take one person on this jury to not believe he's guilty, to not get an acquittal, but to not be able to come to a verdict? Is that my understanding correct?
And Anthony, I'm going to put you on hold, but Laura's going to answer that question.
Yeah, I mean, if you've got a jury or one juror that you know is holding out, so to speak, you know, in layman's terms, yeah, we can have a hung jury.
Yeah. Well, I want to go to a texter, and this is a question that we're all asking. 847 says, "Does it matter that he shot him 16 times instead of one? How do you deal with that issue? Because that is what we call a bad fact."
Yeah. That's a really bad fact. And, I think most people, if they feel that Officer Van Dyke was in the right to use deadly force, I think that they would agree that the first few shots were within his bounds. And but it's the big hurdle that the defense has is having to justify 16 shots. And I don't remember what the number of shots were when he was on the ground, but I know it was a significant number of shots. So, you know, when it comes to justifying those, that number of shots, I mean, he has to justify each of those rounds. Now, keeping that in mind, we also need to understand that, unfortunately, police officers, when they're involved in these rapidly evolving and tense and uncertain situations, they're behind the eight ball, so to speak, and they're reactive. They have a reaction curve, so to speak, that they're behind. And so when they see things, it takes them a half a second, maybe more, to determine what's going on. And likewise, when the threat has been neutralized, or the officer feels that it's been neutralized, it takes time to stop shooting.
Right. No, I mean, you have to explain that, because
right.
And as a police officer, you know that, but we don't know that.
That's right.
Laura, will you stick around with us just for a few more minutes on the other side? Because I think we've got some callers and some texters, and I have some more questions for you.
Sure. Absolutely.
Okay. You're listening to the Karen Conti Show on WGN. Karen Conti Show. We're talking to Laura Scarry, who represents police officers, and we're talking about the Jason Van Dyke trial that's coming up this week. I guarantee you the whole nation will be watching it. It's going to make national news because it's such an interesting case, and the millions of hits that video got are going to make people very, very interested in the outcome. We're talking to Laura Scarry. Laura, let's go to the calls. I think I have Tyrone, who's been waiting. Hi, Tyrone. Welcome to WGN.
Hi, good to be a caller today. I was calling because I had a question about the statute. I know it applies specifically to police officers, but I was wondering, within that statute, does it also say equal force must be used? Because in this case, we know one person had a knife, the officer had a gun, and that's my first question. My second question is, would the police officer be able to use a defense that he was not trained properly to disarm someone who has a knife when the only thing they're teaching is how to shoot somebody at the academy or whatever? Those are my two questions.
Okay, great questions. Tyrone, I'm going to put you on hold. Those are excellent questions. Let's start with the first one.
Yes, with respect to, I think you used the phrase equal force. I think I understand what you're saying. So basically, if an individual comes to a fight with a knife, then police officers, they can use force that's, I guess, and I'm putting air quotes around this, equates to knife force.
Right.
Well, that's not the reality of law enforcement. It really isn't. And, unfortunately, the media, or I should say the general public, we've been trained by Hollywood. And that's not how police work works. And, so unfortunately, more fortunately for police officers, what is required of them is that they have to use the, reasonable amount of force. And the term reasonable, in legal connotations is, or in legal circles, is what a reasonable police officer would have used under those circumstances. Because we all know that, let me give an example of an officer responding to a domestic violence call. And he or she could be in the kitchen, where there's a cast iron frying pan that's on the stove. And if you have an individual who picks up that cast iron frying pan is about ready to just slam that pan into the head of an officer, guess what? I would argue that police officer has the right to use his firearm to defend that. So, this equal force, whatever that is, it's a fallacy.
But a lot of people think it.
I've
heard it. I've heard it talked about in this particular case.
Yes,
and that's just not the situation. Tyrone's second question was, and I'll broaden that question, and that is training. How is training of the police officer in this case relevant to what he did? Is there a defense that I was trained to do this and that's why I did it, and that takes me out of the element of a first degree murder charge?
Well, I would argue that on behalf of the defense that the training is relevant. Whether it's a defense, I'm not sure if it's a defense, but I think it is relevant because if his training, if he received certain training that, basically taught him that he would be justified to use the amount of force that he used in this situation, whether it's a knife or not, then yeah, it becomes relevant what his training was. But I'm not so sure that it would be considered a defense. It certainly should be relevant.
I suppose it would probably show his mindset.
Right.
That he wasn't malicious in his actions. He was just following what his training made him do.
Right.
After all the years. The issue, and Tyrone also touched on this in his written question, he said, what about the cover-up? And there was allegations against some of the other police officers who were with him that there was falsification of records to say what happened that night. And now those people are being given immunity and they may testify on behalf of the prosecution. We don't know the facts yet. We don't know if that's going to happen. But how would that be relevant? Or would it be relevant that there was a cover-up by the police department after the fact?
Well, I would argue on behalf of the defense that it's not relevant. And even if it was relevant, it certainly is highly prejudicial to Officer Van Dyke. Because let's think about this for a minute. What is relevant is what transpired at that moment in time that Officer Van Dyke decided to fire his weapon. That's what is relevant. And, now the prosecution... And by the way, I have a lot of respect for Joe McMahon. I think he's smart. He's intuitive. I can see where the prosecution would want to have, the evidence of the purported cover-up come in.
Sure.
So
why would they cover up something that was right?
Of course.
Yeah.
Of course. So.
But and that there's going to be a fight about that.
Absolutely.
I would see that that's something that Judge Gaunt is going to have to decide. I want to talk a little bit about picking a judge over a jury. And my understanding is that right now we're set for a jury trial and that voir dire, the process of jury selection, will start this week. But there's still a possibility that Van Dyke's attorney might opt for a bench trial, which means it'll be tried before a judge and not a jury. Tell me, as a defense lawyer in a case like this, what are your considerations for opting for a jury or a judge?
Well, there's a couple of things, and I know this case has received quite a bit of media coverage, and so, hopefully the defense can pick a jury that has not heard a lot about this case, nor has seen the video, but and let's hope that the potential jurors have not heard about the potential for protest to follow the jury verdict should it result in some sort of acquittal. So with that publicity of the potential protest, I would venture that perhaps one or two individuals who are on that jury, they may be thinking about that, you know, when they go to, you know, render their verdict. On the other hand, a judge is less prone to those outside variables and factors. And I'd like to believe that our judges are going to stick to the law and they're less emotional about all of these extraneous factors. So I think, you know, that is a huge advantage of having the judge render a decision as opposed to a jury.
I think we should add into the fact that, you know, judges are elected in Cook County. And
yes.
Again, you know, Judge Gaughan is 77 years old, and it may be that he's not going to run next
right.
time for retention. That's where they vote yes or no. But I think that it's going to be an interesting thing. And in my assessment, just having yeah. known a little bit about Judge Gaughan, he would be a good person to try the case because he's got a background that involves him being in the military,
right.
and he's had, you know, he may have some appreciation of what it means to take out a gun and shoot it.
That's right.
Laura, thank you so much for joining us. And will you join us again as this case goes on? Because you got it. I still want to talk to you about being a police officer and how you came into going to law school and representing police officers, but that's for another time.
Sure.
Laura Scarry with the law firm of Deanno and Scarry. How would people get a hold of you if they wanted to talk to you?
Well, that's easy. By telephone, you can call 630-690-2800, or you can contact us at our website, which is www.deannoscarry.com, and that's spelled DEANOSCARRY.com.
Thank you so much. Have a good evening.
Thank you.
Watch Micah and Joe, Micah Martyr and Joe Donlin weeknights on WGN TV News at 9. The right healthcare matters. Riverside Healthcare, the award-winning health system, serves communities just south of the south suburbs. From heart care and neurosurgery to cancer care and orthopedics, Riverside also offers a variety of primary and specialty care providers in locations throughout the region. Riverside offers just the right care for you, the kids, the whole family. When and where you need it most, because convenience matters too. Visit riversidehealthcare.org for locations, services, and to schedule an appointment and more. Riverside Healthcare, putting well within reach.